I think I was taking a funeral and, oh, swear word, I forgot my dog collar. So luckily, you know, you just have to pop into the local petrol station or the local village shop and buy yourself a Bounty. And there's that little cardboard insert. So you just get this little bit of cardboard and snip it to size. With a Bounty bar, you don't actually have to snip it. It's kind of pre-made as a dog collar. And you just slide it into the shirt there.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Country Life Podcast with me, your host, James Fisher. I've got an immensely exciting guest today, a man of many names. It is Reverend Dr. Colin Haber-Percy. Welcome, Dr. Haber-Percy. How are you today?
I'm very well, thanks, James. Very well indeed. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Well, thank you very much for joining. Dr. Haber-Percy, can I just call you Colin?
Call me Colin, please, okay? James. Yeah, call me Colin, definitely. Okay. Yeah.
Colin is a writer of both scripts and books. You may have heard of Tales of a Country Parish, which we'll be talking about a bit later. He has also got a PhD in medieval metaphysics. And if you're wondering what medieval metaphysics is, we'll also find out later on. If I can just start...
You might hope so, James. I'm not sure I've got an answer for you, but I'll do my best.
Well, if you don't have an answer, then I think we're in big trouble. If we could just start with a bit about you, Colin. Where were you born and where did you grow up? And what were some of your first memories of the countryside?
Okay, interesting. I was actually born in London and raised for the first 4 years of my life in London. And my parents moved out of London with my young brother and I when we were small. And we grew up, all of us, in Hampshire in a very sort of isolated corner of Hampshire, actually. So it was a very rural upbringing in the midst of the Hampshire countryside, really. And my brother and I roamed free across farms and woodland and fields and all that sort of thing. It was a very rural upbringing my brother and I had, yeah.
A feral childhood, some might say.
Yeah, slightly feral, I think. Yeah,
probably. Yeah.
I don't know if my brother would agree with me, but I think we turned out pretty feral. Yeah, we're farm cats.
That's fair enough. I can appreciate that. I sort of, in the rich country life tradition, grew up in Manhattan in New York City and then sort of basically moved overnight to the middle of Suffolk, which was quite an exciting
change.
That
must have been a culture shock, wasn't it?
Yeah, a little different. I've never seen a cow before, but that was, you know, you get used to them pretty quickly.
Not many cows in Manhattan,
as far as I remember. No, not a huge amount. Certainly not alive ones, anyway. You're sort of well known as a man of the clergy now, but you began your sort of career as a screenwriter and scriptwriter. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right, James. When I left school, I actually trained as an actor, but quite quickly, I mean, during the training, actually. So in my late teens, early 20s, got into writing screenplays, writing theatre pieces, and things went from that beginning, really. I've always loved working with actors and directors. I still love spending time in theatres and on film sets and things like that. So I just loved the collaborative aspect of writing for the stage and writing for the screen, writing for actors, writing words for people to speak to one another. I've been fascinated by that all my life. I mean, I've always written. So when I've been reflecting on this recently, actually. When I was 12, I think I was about 11 or 12, wrote a sort of dreadful kind of sword and sorcery fantasy novel, which I'd sort of scrawl in a pad and then make my mother type up every evening. I'm sure it was completely and utterly dreadful, but words have always mattered an enormous amount to me. And so theatres and film sets and churches, in fact, places where words are used to communicate are kind of holy places for me. I worked on leaving drama school knowing I didn't want to be an actor, Worked quite quickly in sort of freelance screenwriting, developing sitcoms for the BBC, and then selling film scripts and going on from there. Worked a lot freelance. I was always freelance, sort of a hired gun. Worked with a writing partner, and we worked all over the world doing screenplays for whoever would contract us to do so.
Very good.
I loved it. Yeah. Sorry, James. Go on.
That's all right. That partner is that Lyle Watson.
Lyle Watson. Yeah. Lyle Watson is an absolute genius of and many people in the theatre world know Lyle very well. He was vice principal at RADA for quite a long time, but was by the time I met him was already writing for the theatre, and we just basically sat down together one day and said, let's come up with some stuff. Let's come up with some material, which we did, and we toured it around the UK, Edinburgh Festival and things like that. But then film scripts kind of took over, and I worked with Lyle for years and years and years, and it was a huge, hugely important phase in my life. I learned a very, very great deal from him, and it was incredibly fruitful writing for the BBC. So we wrote things like Casualty 1900s, which was set in the London hospital in the early part of the 20th century. We found ourselves actually, oddly, I mean, we set out to write comedy, but we quite quickly found ourselves being commissioned to write historical drama based on quite careful research. So we wrote Casualty 1900s. We wrote a film for Channel 4 called Saving the Titanic about the men who worked in the dynamo room, in the engine room, and in the coal bunkers on the Titanic. That was for Channel 4. We wrote spent a lot of time in ancient Rome, it seemed.
Yeah.
which was fantastic too. We did all sorts of stuff. Krakatoa. So, you know, lots and lots of things that were based on historical research.
Yeah, and a Sharp film as well. I'm sure I love those books.
I absolutely love those books. That was a great job. I'm casting my mind back now. I don't think that script actually was ever shot, really, which was sad.
Yeah.
But we did develop ideas for the Sharp series too. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, very cool. And then in your 40s, you decided, actually, no, it's time to take the cloth.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, it was. I'd always been involved in the church. I'd always, you know, since being very. My grandmother was a very formative influence in my life, and she was a very sort of. How can I put this? She was curious about faith. She wasn't a conventional Christian, but I was very much drawn to her way of exploring big questions of faith and meaning and purpose in life and the kind of the moral implications of living in a certain way. And so I was always open to the idea of a Christian life, a Christian way of life. And I remember I was writing for the BBC at the time, and an idea came in. They were looking for writers to write the Easter drama for, gosh, this is back probably sort of 15, 20 years ago. And the producer rang me and said, "You're not interested in this sort of religious malarkey, are you?" And I said, "Well, actually, yes, I am." And those were her words. I remember it very clearly, religious malarkey. And the idea was to set the story of the Passion, so the Easter story, and for reasons which I don't think I ever fully understood, we were to retell the story of the Passion of Christ in Preston in Lancashire.
Of course, yeah.
Which Lyle and I both worked on this, and we told the story of the Passion from three points of view, from the point of view of Pontius Pilate, from the point of view of Mary, the mother of Jesus, and from the point of view of Jesus himself. And so exploring the story from those three angles, Pontius Pilate became a mill owner in Lancashire, a wealthy mill owner in Lancashire in the 19th century. Mary, the mother of Jesus, was the mother of a soldier fighting on the front in the First World War and hearing the news that her son had been killed in battle. And the story of Jesus was a contemporary story about a young carer bringing up her younger siblings while her mother struggled with addiction. And I found that experience really, really delving into and looking at the resonances of the Passion story. I found it unbelievably moving. And already I was exploring at that point the possibility of a calling to ordained ministry.
Yeah.
I mean, screenwriting sounds glamorous and it sounds exciting. It is exciting, not glamorous at all, but it is exciting. and I loved the work. I loved the writing. And I've got incredibly fond memories of that career. But after a bit, you recognize that there's meaning and value in a different sort of life, actually. My final job, I was working for the History Channel on a story about ancient Rome and the sort of barbarian invasions. And it was so silly. Am I allowed to say that? I don't know. It was so silly and so much money being spent.
Yeah.
And I just thought, no, I don't want to do this anymore. I need to find real value elsewhere.
Yeah.
In my life. And so the final straws were writing the Preston Passion for the BBC, which was incredibly moving and powerful, spending time in Preston. And then the ridiculousness of working in television and wanting to find meaning, depth and purpose through faith. And that's that. Those two came together and tipped me. I'm going to make this decision. It was a big decision. I had a young family at the time, and screenwriting on and off, you know, it's always precarious, but it was quite often lucrative. And the idea of training for ministry in the Church of England seemed very, very strange thing to do, but I'm very glad I did it, my word.
Yeah. Well, as long as you're happy you made the right choice, then the right choice it must be.
I think so. Yeah.
Well, you've not entirely given up on writing. And I'd like to talk about harking our minds back to sort of March, spring 2020, when you began a newsletter in the middle of a sort of first lockdown that became quite successful. What was the inspiration behind that newsletter? And did you ever think it would get as popular as it did?
No, I certainly didn't think it would get as popular as it did. And James, in some ways, going back to your point about still writing, yes, I'm writing more now than I ever did. And I would say this, wouldn't I? But I think this is, in a sense, I feel, part of a calling.
Yeah.
And that things have come into alignment in a way that they weren't before. So prior to ordination, I think I had these kind of disparate strands of my life. There was a church life, there was writing, there was academic screenwriting, there was academic life, and they didn't really form a coherent pattern. But with ordination and continuing to write, they've been woven together in a way that is so unbelievably deeply satisfying. And I remember having a conversation with a dear friend who said, you know, your ministry in the Church of England and your writing, they're just two sides of the same coin. And that was deeply wise and has proved correct. Mm. So in a sense, that's an answer to the question about the lockdown, your second question about the lockdown, because, and again, not wanting to sound pious, it was March 2020, so 4 years ago, almost to the day, I suppose. You know, like everybody, completely taken aback and shocked by here we are in the 21st century, sitting in front of a TV, and the Prime Minister is saying you've got to stay in your homes, you can't go outside, you can't gather in your places of worship, you can't go shopping, only essential trips out for medication and food supplies and so on. And the whole idea of lockdown was so alien and so shocking. And so upsetting. I couldn't, my job is a face-to-face job. And I think that's what sets sets it apart from writing, where you're sitting at a screen. My job is done, obviously, in churches on Sundays, but quite often over a cup of tea in someone's house or sitting at someone's hospital bedside, in care homes, in all sorts of contexts. No longer can I do this job. I can't. How can I connect with the people I'm called to care for and love? And it was unbelievably frustrating having to talk to people on the phone. People in real distress, facing the disaster of separation from loved ones and so on. How can I be a comfort? How can I console the people that I'm called to care for? So I was walking. I live in a really, really beautiful part of rural Wiltshire. Mm. And I was walking on the downs, as I think I was allowed to do. I can't remember. Was I breaking the rules? I might have been breaking the rules.
I think around March it was. That's when the police were sort of chasing people around with drones as they were walking their dogs in the middle of the Yorkshire Moors.
I didn't see any drones, and they didn't catch me. There's no one around here. It's a tiny village, so perhaps I could have claimed I was taking my daily exercise. I can't remember, but I was walking on my own in the hills, and it struck me. Well, it didn't strike me. I felt convicted, really, James. Wow. And I don't want to sound pious, but what can I do to help? And I felt called to. You know precisely what you can do, Colin. In a way, what do you do? What do you think? What are you doing? I've always written. Like I said, I've always written since I was a child. Go home, sit down, and start writing an email that you can send out, perhaps with a Bible reading and a prayer, but a reflection, something to console, something to comfort, something to challenge, something to connect. Actually, I was writing to connect with the people that I've grown to love in the parishes that I serve. So, how can I connect with them? I can connect by sending out an email. So I started doing that daily, and it was to a small group of parishioners initially, and they started sharing those emails. And quite soon, under the circumstances, you can't really get, I don't know, can you say it went viral when we were dealing with a virus? But that's effectively what happened. So the emails got shared and shared and shared, until there was a really large group of people that I was communicating with daily. And the emails I'd get back from people were, honestly, James, I will treasure some of these emails till for the rest of my life. I remember one set of emails particularly. So getting into a correspondence with a guy who was in intensive care with COVID, and the chaplain at the hospital would sit at his bedside and read the reflections to him every day. And that communication with that man at that critical point in his life was so profoundly moving. And I got emails from all over the world, people trapped in hotels, people unable to get back to their families, people from all different walks of life in all different appalling situations, people sharing the reflections with neighbors of no faith and neighbors of different faiths, and getting into conversations and connections over discussing the particular passages and the particular reflections. It was an amazing experience. Mm. And eventually a publisher got in touch with me and said, would you consider putting them together as a book, which I did, and it became Tales of a Country Parish. And those tales, like I say in the introduction to the book, they're written to comfort and console and to challenge and to connect. But they are, I think, a little bit of it's a journal of a plague year, describes how that year from March 2020 to Easter 2021, the lockdowns and then the openings up and then the lockdowns, it opens and closes like like the valves of a heart. It beats, and that the book takes you through a year of that experience, lockdown and the trauma that lockdown was. But it also takes you through the natural year, the life in a country parish, from spring to spring, the cycle of the seasons and the church year and so on.
Actually, when you said it was exactly 4 years ago to the day, I mean, it quite literally is. But my sort of early memories of that period was just one of sort of immense confusion and more than anything, fear. I, I sort of note in your book that, you know, you talk about taking a call from your higher ups in the church saying, you know, have you got any space in your graveyard in case we've got, you know, overflow? And just a general sense of panic throughout the country about something that we didn't really understand but we knew was deadly. With that in mind, what was it like being a sort of a figure of authority in your community? And what does that mean in terms of the importance of the church and the modern rural community as a whole? I mean, do you think that period and the success of your newsletter highlights that the Church of England, something that can be seen as slightly out of touch, is in fact still very relevant and important today?
Yeah, it's a really good question, James. That really is a fascinating question. I think I'd have to begin by saying I'm writing and thinking and living and working in a rural context.
Yeah.
And I think you would find a different answer from someone working in an urban or a suburban context.
Yeah. That's my other podcast, so it's fine.
Okay. Well, for this podcast, we're talking about country life in a way. And I think in a rural context, so in many of the villages that I look after, the church is the only public building in the community. No pub, no post office, no shop. That's not the case in all the villages, of course. But in some cases, the church is the focal point. It's the center. It's where the community gathers. It's where the community gathers to worship. It's where the community comes together to enjoy concerts and to hear talks. It's the context in which the community gathers in grief and in joy at baptisms and weddings and so on, or at funerals. And the church in these places is still a glue. It's still something that is vital and living. And I think when we hear it from, when we in this context hear talk of decline, it's sometimes slightly baffling because I took a funeral on Saturday, this Saturday just gone. And in a small village church, we packed to capacity, standing room capacity, 300 people.
Oh, wow.
The church and faith are still enormously, invaluably important aspects of people's lives in the villages. And it would be impossible to overstress how important the rural parish is. I would say that, and it's where friendships are forged. So, you know, my daughter's best friend is someone she met in church when she was, you know, a toddler, and still best mates age 19. So, there's an aspect of it which is about community. Of course, there are other aspects which we could talk about to do with faith. But just as community, I hate to say use a word like this, but as a community asset, the village church is invaluable.
No, I'd agree. I mean, some of my earliest memories of living in the UK was countless fundraisers for the church roof. I mean, have you even lived in the countryside if you've not attended a church roof fundraiser?
Well, great, exactly. I mean, the church fate, all those are vital components in the working and the living of a rural village, and it's a joy to be it's a real joy to be part of it. I mean, you said earlier, what's it like to be a figure of authority in that community? I don't see it like that. I must say, I don't see it like that at all. I suppose there's a leadership component to being, you know, the local vicar, but it's more about being present rather than being in charge, and it's just being available, being present, being part of the community rather than leading the community. So I sort of feel very embedded in the community that I serve.
Just quickly on book again, Tales of a Country Parish. What are some of your favourite passages from the book? I particularly enjoyed the part where, and if the Archbishop of Canterbury is listening, please tune out now, you used a cardboard insert from a bounty bar as a sort of makeshift dog collar.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes, yeah, dog collars are a pain because they're so easy to lose. You know, you have to remember, everyone has to remember, you know, that their wallet, their car keys, their mobile phone, whatever. I have all that to remember. Plus, I've got this annoying little insert to go in my shirt, always leaving it behind, always forgetting it, always losing it. So I can't remember. I think I was taking a funeral and, oh, swear word. I forgot my dog collar. So luckily, you know, you just have to pop into the local petrol station or the local village shop and buy yourself a bounty. And there's that little cardboard insert that you can... I've done this several times, actually. Not always with bounty bar. Am I allowed to say bounty? Chocolate bar.
Other
chocolate bars are available. Are available. Anyway, so you just get this little bit of cardboard and snip it to size. With a bounty bar, you don't actually have to snip it. It's kind of pre-made as a dog collar. And you just slide it into the shirt there.
Is this something that you discovered, or is this sort of common knowledge at you know, when they teach you to become a...
No, I think it's a case of necessity being the mother of invention. I discovered it. I don't know if others may have discovered it
at the same time,
but it's a handy tip. So for any other clergy listening out there, avail yourself of a chocolate bar and you've
always
got a ready-made dog collar.
Always have a bounty to hand, just in case. Yeah.
Well, never go out without a bounty. Yes. I think that's a good idea anyway, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think, not my favourite chocolate bars, but I know some people do like them. But
The local bishop here, his favourite is fruit and nut. But you see, if you've got a fruit and nut, there's no cardboard in that. You can enjoy the chocolate, but you've got no backup.
Yeah, you were just turning me towards the idea of becoming a minister, and then I heard the bishops into fruit and nut, and I've sort of gone off the idea all over again.
Disgraceful. Yeah.
So it's Easter this weekend, and you have very kindly written a piece for us in the magazine about Easter. It has what I would describe as a punchy first sentence for a man of the ministry to write, which is, "I'm an agnostic." There, I've said it. How can you be a vicar, Colin, and call yourself an agnostic? So I will ask you the same question. How can you be a vicar, Colin, and call yourself an agnostic?
Okay. Well, without rehashing the leader article, James, agnostic just means not knowing.
Yeah.
And I think we've come to think of it as a label, you know, think of it as a spectrum. There's this spectrum: atheism, agnosticism, and faith. And agnosticism is somewhere, it's sort of like the third way or the liberal democrat position.
It is. It's the fence position.
Exactly. But actually, it's a much richer term than that, because it just means not knowing. And it strikes me, it seems to me, and has done for a long time, and I think Tales of a Country Parish is probably shot through with this idea, and I'm wrestling with it now for another book. The idea that not knowing is an extremely valuable position to have and to hold, not just in terms of your religious faith, but actually in terms of, if you're a scientist, not knowing is kind of what impels you. I don't know, and I want to. So starting from not knowing is a completely vital place in all human endeavor and inquiry. What would be the point of endeavor and inquiry if we didn't start from that place of, well, I don't know, I want to? It's a deeply creative and, I would say, theologically rich space in which, philosophically rich space to inhabit. We're in good company when we say we're agnostic or we don't know. St. Paul himself, in that incredibly famous passage, chapter 13, 1 Corinthians, you know, "Now we see in a mirror dimly. Now I know only in part, but then I will know." But knowing only in part, that's effectively a definition of agnosticism. I haven't got the full picture. I'd love to have the full picture, but I don't have it. And I think inhabiting that space of not knowing, of knowing only in part, is how we're called to live as human beings, actually.
Yeah,
we don't have the answers. When we think we've got the answers, it strikes me that the enemy here is certainty, surety, when we're absolutely convinced that we're right. You know, what starts wars? People talk about religion starting wars, and in a sense, that's a good case to make. But it's the religion, it's the forms of religion that are entirely sure of themselves, that are entirely certain that we've got the answers and we can put a full stop to this. We know exactly what the answer is. It's that certainty that underpins, it can underpin religious faith, and then it's no longer faith, in my opinion, but it can also underpin philosophy or science. When we think we've got the answer, when we're entirely sure, and when there are no qualifications to that answer at all, this is it. Yeah. We've got it all nailed down. Then I think we're in a very arid place and a very dangerous place. So agnosticism, I would say, is rich. And at Easter, of course, the Easter story is full of agnosticism. Mm. The disciples on the road to Emmaus, they've got no idea who they're talking to. They don't know who the stranger on the road is. Mary at the empty tomb on Easter morning, she mistakes the man she's speaking to. She thinks he's the gardener.
Mm.
She doesn't know. And not knowing is when we are, I think, available. We make ourselves available to revelation.
Yeah.
If we've already got the answer, then there's no need for revelation. There's no need for faith. But when we allow ourselves into that space of not knowing, then the light can break in, I think.
I would agree. I think it's a very important message nowadays, without getting too political, but it would be nice if some people in the world would actually just be a bit more honest and put their hands up and say, I don't know, because it's fine not to know.
Of course it is.
Yeah.
Of course it is. I think we do this all the time. We live in a state of not knowing, and when we convince ourselves that we've got all the answers, we're lying to ourselves. And there is no health in us, as the confession would have it. So I think the healthy place is the agnostic place, as precisely as you say, because it requires of us a level of humility, which we all of us, without getting too political, we'd like to see more of humility in public discourse, perhaps in our religious witness too. We're called to walk humbly with our God, and I think that means being open to the fact that we haven't got the answers.
Very good. In the vein of humility and humbleness, I've just clicked my fingers and made you the Archbishop of Canterbury. What would you change in the church if you were Archbishop of Canterbury for a day?
I got to be Archbishop of Canterbury for an hour once when we reenacted the coronation service at the Platinum Jubilee.
Oh, very good!
And it was such a wonderful experience with the local primary school. We had a Queen, we had Earl Marshall, Duke of Edinburgh, everybody, and I got to do the anointing and everything. It was incredibly moving, actually. What would I change if I were Archbishop of Canterbury? Oh my word, James! What? How am I going to answer that? Let's hope no one's actually let's hope the Archbishop isn't actually listening. I think, how can I put this? This is very, very general, and the job must be impossible. And the job would be impossible, and I can't think of anything worse than it, really, because I think it's so political. But I'd want to focus, as you can probably tell from the conversation we've already had, I would want to stress, it's a vague word, but the spirituality and the depth and the humility of the Christian faith. I think I'd step back. I'd try to step back. You probably can't. I mean, you know, this goes back to the first part of our conversation in a way, James, because when I was a freelance screenwriter, I was a lone gun. Well, Lyle and I were lone guns. You know, the office was your laptop and your bag, and you go from contract to contract. You don't belong for very long in any given situation. You move from job to job to job, from screenplay to screenplay, and so on. And finding myself in my 40s, suddenly part of a massive, hallowed, huge institution and establishment, at the heart of the establishment, like the Church of England, has been incredibly discombobulating. It's confused me deeply, and I'm reflecting on that at length at the moment. What does it mean to belong in an institution like this? We've all belonged in institutions, you know, in our schools, and in various ways through our lives, with the organizations that we work for and so on. But I'm finding it very difficult. And so the thought of being head of it would be... You know, it's bad enough being part of it, the thought of being head of it. I wouldn't know where to start. I find institutions and establishments and organizations and structures and hierarchies and frameworks really, really difficult to cope with. One of the hardest things I do in my daily work as a parish priest is being the governor of a Church of England primary school. And when you see how bureaucracy, management, and you know, a kind of rising tide of managerialism, data collection, curriculum, that, you know, the curriculum, Ofsted, the whole thing, I find very, very difficult, because I think I like the idea of trusting in the grassroots. So if I were Archbishop of Canterbury, it would be like, I think it would be, and if I really had carte blanche, it would be devolving power back into the grassroots. I think that's where the kingdom grows. It doesn't grow sitting around a committee table in church house. It grows in villages, in parishes, in neighborhoods and streets. I would want to see a renewed level of trust and support for the grassroots, for the parish system. That would be my direction of travel. So I'd love the idea of a church that is kind of centrifugal. So that, you know, the power it flows outwards into the parishes, rather than what it is at the moment, which strikes me as being a bit centralized, centripetal, if you like. So there's the vision and the strategy of the church is delivered from the center, and I rather think it should be a bit more, you know, it's like, you know, without getting sort of too philosophical, Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari, their distinction between a structure or a way of looking at the world which is arborescent, and fancy 20th century French philosophical word for being like a tree with a massive trunk. Their idea of a structure that is rhizomatic, so more like a fungus, something that flows out and is a more horizontal idea rather than a vertical idea. I'm really drawn to that. That's my that would be my arch. Is that a manifesto? I hope not. That would...
It's good. I like it. No, that's a very good answer. It's a very good answer, and I definitely have a friend of mine who will absolutely be bobbing his head viciously in agreement. I've got one last question for you, if that's okay, and then I think, unfortunately, we'll run out of time. And I mentioned it right at the beginning. You're a doctor of medieval metaphysics.
Yeah.
Now, I know my friends
really
are
really useful, that.
but I need to ask you, what
comes in really handy.
Because when someone says medieval metaphysics, I'm thinking, like, you know, how does a trebuchet work or something like that? What is medieval metaphysics?
That would be medieval ballistics, wouldn't
it?
Well, I mean, there's a simple answer, but then it can get quite complicated. Metaphysics is just, I suppose, an inquiry that leads towards the very general brushstrokes here, broad brushstrokes. Metaphysics is the branch of philosophy that is essentially an inquiry aimed at understanding ultimate reality. So it would look at reality, existence, causation, and so on. The idea being, in metaphysics anyway, I mean, metaphysics is a dirty word, or has it less so these days, but was a dirty word for most of the 20th century. So the idea, whether it's in Aristotle or Kant, all the way up from Aristotle to Kant, until you get to people like David Hume, who kind of critiques metaphysics. But metaphysics is the idea that, you know, we can try, we might fail, but there is... This would be a Kant position, in a sense, that there is a transcendent reality that we can inquire into as best we can through rational thought. For Hume and for those who followed in the empiricist tradition, All we can ever know is what's delivered to us through our senses, through our empirical understanding of the sensory world around us. And anything that suggests you've got access to transcendent reality is just nonsense or meaningless. So in the 20th century, heirs of Hume, like Carnap or Russell and so on, for them, metaphysics is just kind of meaningless babble. I think that, you know, without going into a long conversation, that's no longer the case.
Yeah.
So it's in a sense, it is the rational inquiry aimed at understanding the ultimate reality. Now, that can include God, but it needn't. And medieval metaphysics is just how they did that in the medieval world. And if you want to do medieval metaphysics, you know, I got my doctorate in philosophy considerably before I was ordained.
Yeah.
But I did approach the subject with faith. And I think a capacity to, in medieval metaphysics, there is God looms large. I think you can do metaphysics without God. But the idea, as soon as you start talking about essence, existence, ultimate reality, of course, there's going to be a theological component, potentially a theological component that looms. And in medieval metaphysics, of course, that looms large.
Yeah.
But I think it's still a very worthwhile subject looking into how metaphysics was done, you know, in 13th century Paris, for example, or before, which was kind of where I worked most, was in the 9th century. I was fascinated by Neoplatonism. But anyway, that's a can of worms there.
We'll talk about that if when you come back on in a few months.
Yeah, let's
time.
Talk about Neoplatonism next time, James.
That sounds good. Well, that is probably about as highbrow intellectually as this podcast is ever going to get. So, ladies and gentlemen, that is the peak. Thank you so much, Colin, for coming on. It's been a really great chat.
Not at all, James. I've really enjoyed the conversation. It's been lovely chatting. Really great.
Well, hopefully we'll have you back on in the not too distant future. But until then, happy Easter. And thanks again for coming on.
Yeah, happy Easter to you, James. And happy Easter to everyone. Bless you all.
Thank you very much to you, our listeners, as always, for tuning in. And thank you very much to my esteemed editor and producer, Toby Keel. Thanks for listening and see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for bringing up the bounty bars. That sort of lightens the mood a bit, doesn't it? Otherwise, we're going to get too stuck in Thomas Aquinas.
Yeah, too metaphysical.